Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Here's a question. How did any of us find anything before GPS came along? Don't ask me. I don't know either. Today we'll talk to a Harvard physicist who's asking an intriguing question. What do we lose when modern technology like GPS substitutes for our innate capacity to find our own way? We'll have a visit with John Huth in just a minute here, and he joins us right now from where are you joining us from now this morning, Professor? Nice to have you.
Harvard University.
That's very good. Again, he's a Donner Professor of Science at Harvard, John Huth. And John, so good to have you. You are an experimental particle physicist by training, but you got interested in navigation after a tough day of kayaking, of all things. What happened?
Well, actually, two tough days. I had rented a recreational kayak and was paddling off the coast of Maine across a 2-mile embayment. Didn't have a compass with me, didn't give it much thought, and without warning, a huge fog bank started to envelop me. So fighting off panic, I tried to get an idea of natural compasses. So I saw that the wind was blowing out of the southeast, and there was swell coming in from the Gulf of Maine from the southwest. And I could hear waves crashing on a beach off in the distance to the northwest. And I used these as a natural compass to find my way back safely. And that was not a problem. I was somewhat chastened by the experience. However, about 3 months later, it was Columbus Day weekend, I was kayaking off the coast of Cape Cod near my house, shoved off in a recreational kayak. Evidently, I hadn't learned my lesson because I didn't have a compass with me. And I was paddling. And, of course, what would happen? But a fog bank rolled in again. But I had noted the direction of the wind and was able to find my way along the shoreline, and no problem. The next day, I was out paddling, and the harbor master stopped me, and he asked if I'd seen two young women in kayaks. And I asked, well, no, when? And they said they'd been out from this spot called Ayers Beach and had left yesterday at about 3 o'clock. And I said, well, Ayers Beach, that's only about quarter of a mile from my house, and I was paddling at 3 o'clock. So it turned out these two young women, aged 20 and 19, had paddled out, just going out for a 10-minute paddle, told their boyfriends, and they'd been lost in the fog overnight. And there was a huge search and rescue going on. And the next day, they found the body of one of the girls and never found the body of the other girl. And I became sort of obsessed. It was a sense of survivor's guilt, if you like, where, you know, why did they die and why did I live? And the only real answer to that question was that I paid attention to the direction of the wind. So I guess if you allow me to continue, I can sort of tell you something about the effect
it had on me. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So it's the strangest thing. I think if you see something like a tragedy and read about it in the newspaper, you know, of course, it gives you a sense of sadness, but then you turn the page and you're onto something else. But if you survived in a situation where somebody doing the exact same thing died, it just has this horrendous weight that it puts on your shoulders. And one looks for answers or meaning, and of course, the sea can't give you any meaning. It just crashes up and that sort of thing. But I sort of obsessively put myself through a course, my own developed course, where I would look at natural signs for navigation. I would memorize. I memorized the positions of major navigational stars. I learned how to navigate by looking at the waves, how they reflected off of points of land, and this kind of thing. And I soon learned that what I was doing was not isolated, that cultures way in the past, like the Polynesians and the Norse, had used systems like this. And so that was enlightening. But then I guess the most interesting thing happened to me. After about a year, it dawned on me that I was looking at my environment very differently, that I was really seeing myself as part of the environment. The clouds had meaning because they told me if rain was coming. The waves had meaning because they told me about land. And where I was looking for a certain kind of meaning, I found another kind of meaning about my environment, and I felt very connected. Well, if I can continue just a little bit.
Well, let me just hop in here
and remind our listeners that
we're visiting with Harvard Professor John Huth. His new book is The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. And, John, I was sort of interested in just going back to the kayaking thing for a moment. How did you yourself handle this idea of being lost in a situation like that? To what extent did you stay within yourself and not panic?
Well, that's an interesting question. There was a book written by a gentleman that I'd read later that gave me some understanding of this. Apparently, one of two things happen to people in survival situations. Some cases, they become very rigid and latch onto dogma, and that's not a good thing. In other cases, people sort of open up. A lot of people talk about the sense of time almost stopping when they're in a survival situation, and they become very attuned to what's going on around them, almost hypersensitive. And I think that's what happened to me, was that I became hypersensitive to my environment in mm-hmm. that instant.
And you didn't panic?
No, I didn't. I mean, I just said, my life depends on doing, you know, figuring this thing out. I was quite aware of the consequences, but at the same time, I said, you can't panic at this point. You have to really put your mind to the task at hand and push out any other sense of panic.
What do you think most people do wrong when they get lost?
Well, panic, actually.
Yeah.
As it turns
Speaking
out,
of the
this
word,
is,
yeah.
The I think what often happens is they try to latch onto some preconceived notion or some idea and then just fixate on that one thing, and that usually leads them into trouble. When I talked with the harbor master well after the tragedy, I asked, what do you think went wrong? And there's a far out to sea, about 2 miles out to sea, there's a buoy that makes a groaning noise in the wave action, and it warns people about a shoal there,
mm-hmm.
and he thinks that they heard this and thought that it maybe marked the entrance to a harbor and just paddled resolutely towards this without thinking about, you know, can I hear car noises and land and that sort of thing. And so I think they might have fixated on one thing, and that tends to be the problem. You have to find multiple signs that reinforce a sense that you're doing the right thing.
Hmm. What do you think people should be thinking about when they get in situations like that, John? What would you advise?
Stop.
Stop.
First thing to do is to basically do a rational assessment. I think what panic tends to do to people is it gives them this drive to do anything. And oftentimes, doing the wrong thing can get you into more trouble. There's a phenomenon called wood shock, which is basically a phrase that developed around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century that described that. But it's seen in other cultures, too. Westerners aren't the only ones that experience this. We've mm-hmm. seen this in Polynesian sailors, for example.
Yeah. And what do you think happens to people inside their heads when they become lost? I mean, what's going on up there? What did you find out?
Well, there's a part of the brain that actually carries a map of our surroundings. It's deep inside the limbic part of the brain, and the name of it is called the hippocampus, where actually other parts of our memory are stored. And if you sort of picture your surroundings, where you're standing now or where I'm standing, if you want to go from one point to another, you sort of have a two-dimensional map. It's as if you're hovering over your environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you decide, how are you going to get from one place to the other? And then you actually have some idea of the landmarks on the way that tells you you're making your way there. When you lose your way, all of a sudden that map loses its alignment, and you start to substitute other maps. I have this phenomenon that I call the waking up in a strange hotel in the middle of the night syndrome. Have you ever had that?
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
Right, right. And so you're, where am I? What did I do? What happened? And that sort of thing. And then after a bit of thought, how you got there, all of a sudden everything sort of falls into place. And that's actually that part of your brain that has that map kind of latching on to the right map of your surroundings, and all of a sudden you're not lost. And I think what happens when people get lost is that map basically gets obliterated, and that map actually sits next to a part of the brain that's responsible for emotions. So mm-hmm. you can just imagine that the loss of this thing then talks to that emotional seat in the brain, which sends out all sorts of adrenaline, and the adrenaline floods the system, and you sort of lose the ability to distinguish among all sorts of sensory inputs, and everything gets jumbled up. And I think that's why I say the key is to stop and reduce the panic, because you need to make sense of all the inputs that are coming into your brain and not just get flooded. And the problem with the panic is the flooding sort of overpowers any sort of sense of what's important out there.
You caution people against this very interesting phenomenon. I'd never heard of it before, John. It's called bending the map. What is that exactly?
Yeah, that term comes from a sport called orienteering, where people go out in the woods and they go from one spot to another, and it's basically a race from point to point in an unfamiliar environment. And what happens to orienteering people who get lost is they think they're in a certain place, like they'll see a boulder or a creek or a little pond, and they're actually in a different place. But what they'll try to do is convince themselves that what they're seeing is the things that correspond to where they think they are, and they're actually distorting this. And this is, I've actually seen this in action many times. Mm-hmm. I was on a backpacking trip, and this exact thing happened to my brother-in-law, fascinatingly enough.
Hmm. And what happened there with him?
Well, he was keeping track. We were in an arid environment in southeast Washington state, and it was about 5 or 6 miles between water sources that were mainly springs. And so if you missed a spring, you were in big trouble, because the temperature were getting into the hundreds. And we had a destination, which was a spring in the distance, and we were going to camp there for the night. And even the guidebook said that you might miss the trail off to the side. So I was aware of this issue. He was keeping track of his position by how long it took to walk, but we were walking downhill, and so we were walking faster than we normally would. And we got to this point where I started looking around, and I thought I identified the spring. I was being very obsessive with my map and my compass, and he said that couldn't possibly be the spring because we haven't traveled far enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I think it is. So we got into this nice little glade of trees, and there was a little trail off to the side, and I said, this looks like this is the trail to the spring. He said, no, it can't possibly be. And the creek was flowing in the right direction, and he was coming up with all sorts of reasons why we weren't in the right place. And so I said, I'll tell you what, let's just drop our packs. His son was there and said, why don't you send your son along the trail for 10 minutes? And I sent my son down the trail towards what I claim is the creek, the spring, for 10 minutes. And they'll turn around and come back and report, and then we'll decide on our course of action. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, my son goes down towards the spring, his son goes down the trail, and within 3 minutes, my brother-in-law, God bless him, he's a really nice guy, I'll tell you, but he started off down the trail after his son without, you know, basically going against everything we just decided. Well, as soon as he was out of earshot, what do I hear from my son? He yells up and says, hey, Dad, the spring's down here.
Yeah.
So he comes on back and says, oh, where's Uncle Ken? He said, well, he went down the trail. So my son drops his pack and runs after Ken. Ken comes back, and he says, this can't possibly be it. We walk down the trail, and there's this water coming out of the ground and a big pool and mm-hmm. beautiful campsite. And he said, this can't be the spring.
No. Yeah, there you go. Still not buying it. Yeah.
After about 3 hours, I think he finally got it. But it was it was the most fascinating thing to see in action. He just couldn't believe it. It was just right in front of his nose.
Now, you've sort of mentioned this already, but you talk about these two modes of navigational understanding, John, route knowledge and survey knowledge. What's the difference?
Well, in route knowledge, it's knowing a bunch of paths and their intersections and how to get from one place to another. And typically, if we're in an unfamiliar or new environment and we have a map, we have route knowledge. Survey knowledge is this more sophisticated kind of knowledge, as if you're hovering over an environment and you see everything in two dimensions and know all the points in between. And you might ask, how can you tell the difference whether I have route or survey knowledge?
Mm-hmm. Right? How do you have the difference?
Shortcutting behavior. So if you know that you want to get from one point to another, but you haven't before, and you know you'd have to go down a crowded street and wait at a stoplight, and all of a sudden you say, I think this road over here is going to take me to my destination a lot faster, and you do it, that demonstrates that you have survey knowledge. But if you were slavishly going through that intersection, that would be route knowledge.
Huh. You know, there is this notion that it comes through in your book that, you know, despite having these amazing computers in our pockets and access to limitless knowledge at all times, we're almost more primitive than our ancestors when it comes to navigating ourselves. So what have we lost by virtue of the fact that we have these computers in our pockets with GPS devices in them?
Well, I think that part of our brain, I would sort of pose it as a use it or lose it sort of thing, that I think that our ability to find our way has been degraded, and our ability to pay attention to things in our surroundings has been degraded. And, you know, just look, somebody who's crossing a busy intersection and they're staring at their smartphone along the way, I would submit to you that's enough proof in itself.
Yeah. And so our basic instincts for how for where we are and how to get to where we need to be, we've lost some of that.
I think we have. The good news is that we can get it back, and that's been one of the more rewarding aspects. I teach a course which is actually what spawned the book in the first place, where we take students, many of whom are cell phone addicts, and we teach them the rudiments. And there's a kind of a miraculous moment where they regain this connection. And if you let me, I can kind of describe it to you, if you'd like. So one of the activities we do, or that actually got me engaged, was memorizing the positions of major stars in the sky. And so they have to correlate these with places on Earth so they have an image of what the Earth looks like and how that relates to the stars in the sky. But it starts out, they have to write down the coordinates on a quiz and then have a little grid and plot the stars. And some of them were grumbling, oh, why do we have to do this? We're Harvard students. This is rote memorization, blah, 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 blah. But then we take them to the roof of the science center at night and we say, what's that star and what's that star? And it's this almost instantaneous transformation, you see. It's all of a sudden these things become real. And, you know, all of a sudden they can orient themselves at night when they couldn't before. And it's this, it's like an epiphany. And it's just so amazing to see that, you know, you can succeed when, you know, the students are willing to put in, you know, the effort. And then there's this kind of new knowledge, and it's not atomized of a coordinate of a specific star. It's really this hole, this cognitive hole that they have, where all of a sudden, W-H-O-L-E, where they can find themselves at night by the stars, and all of a sudden it makes sense. It's like a new world to them.
We're visiting with Harvard professor John Huth about his new book, The Lost Art of Finding Our Way, and I should point out that he'll be speaking at the Linda Hall Library at 7 o'clock on Tuesday evening. Tickets are available at lindahall.org for the 7 o'clock Tuesday evening event with Professor John Huth. And if you want to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. Can you find your way around without a GPS? How good or bad are your navigational skills these days? Have they changed? Have they degraded, in Professor Huth's words, as a result of you having a smartphone in your pocket all the time? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, that's 816-235-2888. What other kinds of navigational landmarks, skills should people have to orient themselves either in the city or even out in the woods, John? What are some of the basic ones that people might want to think about?
I would say one of the basic things is being able to walk in a straight line, as silly as that sounds. But
because when you get lost, a lot of times you tend to walk in circles, right?
Yeah. It's actually, if you look at it, people have done studies where they've put GPS trackers on people in a flat forested area on an overcast sky, and it's more of a loopy path. It doubles back on itself multiple times, that kind of thing. And, of course, it can be very unnerving when you cross over your path because you realize that you're back in the same spot you started. So, you know, the first idea is that be able to walk in a straight line. And there are all sorts of tricks for doing that, like the wind. I had some students who did a project where they went out in a flat wooded area in the overcast, and they used the sensation of wind on their face, because if you turn your head sideways one way or the other, you can actually feel a difference in the cooling in your two ears, because your ears have a lot of blood flow through them, right? And so as you rotate your head, you can basically get a sense of the wind direction. And they would go out in the woods and could actually walk in a fairly good straight line just by using the wind, the sensation of the wind. So that's one.
I've also seen you talk about the idea of maybe carrying along with you some sort of tape or whatever that you can write on to help people who might be looking for you. And so you sort of track your way through the woods, and you point out that, hey, Kraske went this way, sort of to help people who might be looking for you track you down.
Yeah, that's the Hansel and Gretel strategy. Well, you know, put yourself in the position of a search and rescue party, right? So the phone call comes in, and you know, my husband's lost. He went out hiking, and da 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 da. And you know, well, where did he go hiking? Well, somewhere in these woods over here, right? Well, so would have been wise to leave word, but maybe not. So now the search and rescue party, they have to go look at this huge two-dimensional forest and look for a point, right? And that's difficult to find. On the other hand, if you take like a surveyor's tape, I carry like a roll of surveyor's tape and a little indelible marker with me. So you go to a tree, maybe at eye height or something like that. You tie off one of these bright pieces of tape and write your name and the direction that you're going. And then you just leave them in a line in the direction that you're moving. So now what the search and rescue party can do is they don't have to find a point in the woods. All they have to do is find this trail that you've left and then follow the trail to where you are. And so that helps them. You have to anticipate what somebody who might be looking for you would do.
So that just means you have to remember to throw the tape in your backpack before you take off to begin with, right?
Yeah. Well, I might be obsessive, but I have a fanny pack with all the things that I might need in a situation like that, including how to get water and that kind of thing.
Well, for our listeners, have you ever been lost and managed to find your way without a map or a GPS? We want to hear your story. Our email address, update@kcur.org, or again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Carl from Kansas City, Missouri. Carl, you're on the show. Good morning.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
Good, Carl. Thanks.
Well, I just wanted to add, you know, sort of my perspective. I always had a good view of the city. I'm very good at navigating throughout Kansas City proper and the suburbs and everything. But with the advent of smartphones and the navigational purposes that they do serve, you know, for getting places that you don't know where you're going, that's always great. But it also gave me like a wider view of the city and the routes that I traverse normally. Whereas before it was sort of just based on landmarks and, you know, kind of my experiences of getting lost is sort of how I have been able to assemble those routes before. But, you know, with my phone, I've been able to kind of see the bigger picture, so to speak, where I guess a Rand McNally would have done the same thing before. But, you know, at this time, it's in my pocket, you know, and I don't necessarily have to be driving down the road to look at it or pulled over on the shoulder.
So your point is the smartphone
comment.
The smartphone has helped you become a better navigator is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's given me a more well-rounded picture of exactly why A to B is the way that it is and how I can sort of store that in my mind. And so I don't have to use my phone, you know, once I've done it the first time.
Carl, I'm glad you called. John, what do you make of Carl's point that maybe the smartphones have helped in a different kind of way here?
Well, I mean, it's a good point, and I'd say that he might be the exception rather than the rule because he seems like he was smart enough to really widen the viewpoints that he could, in effect, use the information on the cell phone as a map. And he says, well, he could have just used a Rand McNally Atlas to the same purpose maybe 20 years ago. So I actually am in full agreement that if you're using it in a much broader perspective, then it's certainly going to function like a map and give you a better idea of where you are. I think the problem is that people have GPSs in their cars that are so focused on a very small area that they frequently don't look at the larger perspective, and then everything is just a set of turn left, turn right, and not really looking at the network.
Yeah.
There's one other thing.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, if you go online and Google the phrase, your GPS is wrong, and then go to images, you'll be treated to about a page of road signs that say that. And frequently, they may be very accurate at locating you, but it's only as good as the data. And a lot of times, you'll be steered to the wrong location.
It's happened to me before, that's for sure. Carol from Kansas City, Missouri. Carol, you're on with John Huth. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you, Carol.
My comment is I think that I went to work recently for a company where I travel into neighborhoods, to residential neighborhoods, and my boss said, well, you'll need to get a GPS. And I said, why? I know my way around. I mean, I know the roads. I don't know the streets in the neighborhoods. And I think that the technology is kind of taking the humanness out of our society and thinking for us instead of having us use our brains more.
And I think that's one of John's central points. Do I have that right, John?
Yeah, I think that's true, that we've kind of, I don't know, ceded control to the instruments. And there is this sense of humanness that, you know, you get when you're actually, I don't know, even stopping and asking for directions isn't a particularly bad thing, in my opinion, because you actually talk to somebody, right? Yeah, you talk to somebody, you know, what's the weather like? Where's a good place to eat? And, you know, pretty soon you're plugged in, and it kind of creates a barrier.
It's kind of interesting how the technology is improving in one way, but taking away in the other, kind of the yin and the yang of our modern society.
Yeah, yeah. Carol, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're talking with author John Huth about The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. That's the title of his new book, this notion that we can't find our way around on our own anymore without a cell phone and a GPS device in our hip pockets. Let's go to Mike from South Kansas City. Mike, you're on the show. Good morning.
Yes, I just want to make two comments. Before I get out on a road traveling, I study a map, and I've got it in my head, okay? And so I don't know if there's maps of the woods. But, okay, that's the plus. The minus is I went up to Canada one time. We got on the lake, and we went out in the boat, and probably a couple of us in one boat, fishing boat. And I was marking trees and stuff like that. And it took me about 3 minutes to get completely lost. And so if I had to depend on my own navigation after that, and I think I'm pretty good, but I'll guarantee I'd still be out there. That was years ago. So Mike, anyway, that's my comment, and I'll hang up.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mike. I've been up in the Boundary Waters in Canada, too, on a houseboat, and have gotten horribly turned around as well. And, you know, it happens, John. It just does, no matter how careful you might be.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been in the Boundary Waters myself.
So yeah.
I met some people who are lost, and I actually drew a little map on a piece of birch bark for them. it's kind of funny. But, yeah.
Well, let's go ahead, John. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, after my book came out, I got a email from a guy who got very lost in Nova Scotia, and he said he really wished he had a GPS with him, and I said, well, how'd you get lost? And he sent me a link to this thing, and he'd been following a compass, but I don't know, most people don't even realize this, but compasses don't really point to true north. You know, they point along a magnetic field line. You happen to be in an area where compasses actually do point to true north, but here in Boston, it's like 15 degrees to the west of north.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So and why is that?
Well, because the Earth's magnetic field, it's like a big bar magnet, and it's all this complicated stuff happening inside the Earth. And the magnetic field lines point towards something called magnetic north, but magnetic north isn't at the North Pole. It's somewhere in the Canadian Arctic, basically. And so depending on where you are, the compass is going to point off of the direction of true north. It's going to follow the magnetic field line. So
much for compasses. There you go.
Well, you got to know.
Yeah. Let's do this, John. Let's take a break. Okay. When we come back, Please. We'll continue our good conversation here. We'll get phone calls from Kathy, Lynn, Rick, and Clarence, and a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're visiting with John Huth about his new book, The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. He'll be speaking in town next Tuesday at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Linda Hall Library. Tickets are available at lindahall.org. You know, John, I'm wondering, how did the great discoverers like, you know, Columbus and Magellan find their ways in an era before maps and before GPS? And did they even have compasses back in those days?
Yes, compasses appeared on the scene around the 13th century and was a revolution in map making. And then, rather curious twist of events, let me ask you what people might have used latitude and longitude for in the Middle Ages. Just take a guess.
Find water. I have no idea. Yeah.
For astrology.
Okay.
So in order to cast a horoscope for somebody's life, you have to know the position of stars and these positions in the sky called houses. You might know that song, you know, The Age of Aquarius, when the moon is in that
center. Yeah, right.
So that's a spot in the sky. So in order to do this properly, you need the latitude and longitude of a person and their place of birth and their time of their birth to cast this. So in the early, I guess in the mid 15th century, the Portuguese wanted to go around Africa to get to the Spice Islands, and the king of Portugal actually hired an astrologer to basically invert the process. So rather than knowing where you are and figuring out the stars in the sky, you know the stars in the sky and you figure out where you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, the astrologers were conscripted into figuring out positions. And Columbus was one of the first people to pick up on this and did a lot of fairly primitive navigation by the stars, but he improved over his four voyages, and then that's really what developed into modern celestial navigation.
That's tough, though, isn't it? Navigating a ship across the ocean based on the stars. The stars are moving. You're moving. I mean, how does that work?
Well, it's you can look at how the Polynesians use them. That might be one of the easiest ways. One concept is the idea that certain stars will pass right over the midpoint in the heaven over your head, which is called the zenith, and that can give you your latitude. So if you know the latitude, it's called the declination, but let's call it the latitude of the star, you can get a sense of your position just by knowing which stars are passing right overhead at some time at night. And over time, you can get a sense of this for where the stars are setting and rising to. It can act as a natural compass. So that's kind of the imprecise way of doing it.
I was going to say it's imprecise. If you're lost in the woods, that's not going to help you a whole lot, right?
Except as a direction-finding thing.
Yeah.
And then there's more sophistication where you couple it with latitude and longitude and charts, and you use a device like a sextant, which can measure the height of the star in the sky, and you can do some calculations to figure out where you are. But it's doable. I mean, it's something that normal human beings have been known to do in the past.
Yeah. Sextant, how accurate is that?
About 1/60th of a degree.
Wow.
Which is pretty good. That actually is equivalent to 1 mile, basically. And I think with the sextant, if somebody uses it properly, you can find your location to certainly better than 5 miles and maybe 2 miles or so.
Yeah. Again, we're visiting with John Huth, his book, The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. We're talking about this. We've lost our ability to find our way because we have all these mini computers in our pockets. It's the lost art of knowing where the heck you are and how to get where you need to be. Okay, let's go to Lynn from Kansas City, Missouri. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning. Great show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to tell you a funny story. Last night, my son and his fiance picked me up for dinner, and we were in the Northland. So people in the north don't really know the south. People in the south don't really know the north.
That's the truth.
Kansas City.
Yep, that's true.
So we left the Briarcliff area, went across the river. He had his GPS on, and it was giving verbal instructions. I said, honey, I know where we're going. We're going to the west side. It's not far. He insisted on using the GPS with his mother in the back seat, who knew where we were going, and was just as accurate as the GPS. And I thought it was typical of kids today that, you know, even though somebody says, I know exactly where we're going, I'll tell you where to turn, we still had to have the voice of God and the GPS to direct us.
Oh, that's funny. I hear you, Lynn. I hear your frustration. I've been there myself. Thanks for the phone call. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Kathy from Lawrence. Kathy, you're on with John Huth. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
Well, this has always been one of my pet peeves. I have been lucky enough to inherit my father's navigational abilities, and he pretty much had St. Louis in his brain because he drove and delivered things all
right.
over the city, and it's huge. My daughter, at the age of 18, absolutely freaked out when we were there, and she realized we didn't have the GPS, and she wanted to go to visit her cousin, and she wanted to go to her favorite malls while I worked in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
And she just couldn't deal with the fact that she was going to have to follow directions. and you know, after writing out very detailed directions and her doing the trip a couple of times, she realized that she could actually do this, but she still will not give up the GPS, no matter what.
Yeah. I bet your students are the same way, John. Do I have that right? They'll never give them up, no matter how much you try to teach them.
Some do. I mean,
really?
It's a little bit surprising. We've had a few converts in my group. I wouldn't say it's a huge fraction, but some of them are willing to toss out their cell phone.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's go to Rick. Rick from South Kansas City. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Good
very
to have
interesting
you.
Show. The reason I was calling is I've had the opportunity over the years to be with a lot of different people, and I have found that this skill set is very much gender-based, and I don't mean to be pejorative, but men have, in my lifetime, have seemed to have this skill set far more so than women, and women generally admit to being directionally challenged. And I was wondering what your guest had to say about that, if he found any linkage between this kind of skill set between men and women.
Which gender is better directional, better when it comes to directions, John?
Directions and finding their way in that whole sphere of transport.
And I'm not touching that one, John. I'm going to leave it in your good hands here. Yeah.
I think sometimes it's less a question of maybe the genetics than what one uses. I mean, I guess there's what did men do in the old days when there were no filling stations where they could refuse to go in and ask for directions? You know, sometimes we're, you know, so adamant that we know what we're doing, we're not going to ask for directions,
right?
And our wife's in the seat next to us going,
right,
batty, you know, because we're getting lost and everything. So I think there has been some evidence from psychologists that men have good 3D spatial orientation. But I'm not sure that it really necessarily translates into the ability to navigate, because I've seen, at least in my students, that the women seem to pick it up as much as the men do. And that's partly because they're given the same tasks. And I think maybe the difference is that your listener, that Rick, right, his name, is saying that it may just be, you know, that one values the navigational skills over the other and pays attention to it more. But I've seen women in the same situation doing the same assignments as men and seem to do equally well. You know.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate
it.
Yeah, you're still here.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Rick.
My question was, is I gather your guest is looking at this differently in terms of being reading a map and spatial orientation and simply being able to traverse terrain, know one's physical location in relationship to things. Am I understanding that piece of it correctly then?
It's really both of them. In some of the assignments, we actually have them make a physical map based on walking and keeping track of directions. So it kind of straddles the two. In some cases, they go into an unknown terrain. And there, actually, we did see a bit more dispersion between of women where they ended up than men. But then when you get to the sort of the precision of making a map of your surroundings, they seem to do equally well.
Rick, thanks for the call. What about the old adage that moss always grows on the north side of trees? Because you deal with that in the book as well, John. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of true in the following sense. So when the sun in the northern hemisphere, the sun, especially in our temperate zone, the sun traverses to the south of us. So that means that it tends to dry out the south side of the tree,
mm-hmm,
whereas the north side of the tree is in shadow and tends to retain moisture. Now, moss doesn't have a vascular system. It doesn't have roots. So it depends on moisture from dew and the like, mm-hmm, to keep it going. So for an isolated tree that is exposed to the sun, yeah, probably would work. But if you're in the forest or something like that and there's no light that penetrates to the floor of the forest, I'd say forget it.
Mike from Overland Park emailed us this. So far, you've talked to callers who have a pretty good sense of direction. Well, I'm from a line of men who can't find their behinds from a hole in the ground. I've always been astounded by those people who can say, even at night from inside a windowless building, well, we're facing to the north here, and doggone it, it turns out they're right. So why is it that there are some of us who have almost an uncanny sense of getting lost?
You mean the uncanny ability to get lost?
Uncanny ability to get lost.
Yeah, or inability to find your way.
Yes.
That's a good question. I mean, there's a huge dispersion in skills. I mean, some people are great at music. Some people aren't so great at music. Some people are good at abstract concepts and not. So I think in some ways it has to do with the ability to visualize things. There seems to be a tight connection to me to visualization, whether it's surroundings or, you know, one's body in relationship to a room or something like that. and this ability to navigate. And I just see that there is a wide range of that. But I, again, would claim it's something that can be taught.
Hmm. Rock from Kansas City, Missouri. Rock, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks. Great show.
Thanks.
I was in Moscow, Russia, several years ago, and after being on the plane for about 23 hours and then trying to catch some sleep, I decided I would go jogging the next morning, and I assumed I'd just go straight out and be able to find my way back, and naively thought that. And after a few blocks away, I had absolutely no idea where I was. I had no ID because I had jogging clothes on. No one in Moscow spoke English that I asked about. So I didn't exactly panic, but I was certainly a bit concerned. And obviously there was no danger. And but I just wondered if your guest had any tips on if you're in a foreign city where no one speaks English and you can't find
your
way. If there are any tips, yes. What do you do? How do you find your way back?
Yeah, gotcha, Rock. Yeah.
Well, the trick, it's not so difficult, is as you're going out, you look at you look behind yourself at the way you came.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at the appearance of the hotel when you leave the hotel. You walk down the block, you turn back, you look at the appearance of the block, you turn the corner, you look at what you see as you were approaching that corner. And that's actually how a lot of people get lost, is they are just fixated on moving ahead and don't know what it looks like when they turn around to go back. And so it looks unfamiliar when they turn around to go back and they don't know where to go. And it's true for hunters, too, because they'll get obsessed looking at animal tracks and not turn around, or people hunting for mushrooms, that sort of thing. Same deal. They get so focused on what's in front of them that they don't look around at what the back trail is.
Well, John Huth's book is The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. Again, you can see and hear him next Tuesday evening at 7 at the Linda Hall Library. For tickets, just go to lindahall.org. And, John, you've been just a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking some time. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, too. Thanks very much, Steve.
You bet, John. All the best.